Coming up on this week's episode of Check Your Balances, a mailbag episode where we address a great state that we missed and cleaning up some of the information on our carve-out rule. Stick around. That's coming up next.
Check Your Balances is a show produced and owned by Kraftwerk Capital. The views expressed by the hosts and their guests are personal opinions and should not be considered personal financial advice or the opinion of Kraftwerk Capital. All investments have risk and may lose money. Consult with your financial advisor, tax preparer, or attorney prior to implementing anything discussed, and please do not use this show as the sole basis for financial decisions.
Welcome back to another week of Check Your Balances. I am Ross Anderson, joined as always by my friend and co-host, Dan Maseka. Good to see you, bud.
Always great being here.
It is time for a mailbag episode. Can you believe we are doing an October mailbag right now? I feel like September is gone in a flash, just instantly gone.
It's part of getting old, I think. Every day I'm saying, I can't believe we're this far in the year, that it's this year reunion. Time flies. Got to enjoy it.
I guess so. Yeah, that seems like what happens to me more and more these days. But I am excited that we're digging into the mailbag today. We got a bunch of good questions. We're getting to the point where we can't even get to all of the questions that we're getting in, which quite frankly is a point of pride for me. Like I'm glad that people are engaged in the show and they have things that they want us to weigh in on. It's also meaning that we're having to start being a little bit more selective. So we will try to get to everybody's question as we can, but let's kick it off with a longtime listener that once asked us to refer to him as an anonymous ophthalmologist. So we're going to start with his question. He writes in and says about our where to retire that Hawaii is an under the radar retirement state. Hawaii is actually a very good place to retire financially. Employer sponsored pension plans and Social Security are not taxed by the state. If your income is derived from these two things, it is possible to have $100,000 due in federal income tax and zero state income tax. Sales tax is 4%. They call it GET, but it's the same thing. And property tax is very low. On an owner-occupied home worth $1 million, property tax is less than $2,000 a year, and we have pretty good weather. I think that he's right with many of those things. I've never been to Hawaii. Dan, have you been there?
I haven't. I'd like to.
The flight has always scared me off. I think I would want to go for at least a couple weeks. Now, maybe this is unfair. I think the perception, at least for me, is that the natives and people that are like from Hawaii don't want people moving there. And so I'm surprised that somebody that lives in Hawaii would make the suggestion. But maybe I'm completely misinformed.
Maybe he just wants us specifically in Hawaii, which is fine with me.
I'm here for it. Now, not knowing anything about Maui, I pulled up a city in Hawaii just to do the bestplaces.net comparison. Looks like an expensive place to buy a home, at least by most standards.
Totally. When we got this email in, I think he might be right about a lot of what he said. But anecdotally, I always thought of Hawaii as an expensive place to buy things because they have to get a lot brought into the island, which can increase the cost of goods. And looking at the best places comparison, we used Fairfax, Virginia, close to us as a comparison to see what the actual difference would be between living there versus here. The cost of food and groceries is 153.2 relative to a national average of 100. So 50% higher there than in most places. Fairfax, by comparison, is at 114. So just 14% higher than the national average for food and groceries, things we'll be consuming routinely.
The other one that surprised me was the utilities number at 182%. Again, I think that's speaking to kind of the challenge of either getting power to the islands and getting things out there versus we're basically right at the national average here in Fairfax. And then there's the whopper number, which is the median home cost. The national average median home cost, $338,100. So across the entire United States. In Fairfax, $654,000. And Dan, I'm going to let you drop the hammer on, by the way, so this is specific to, is it Kanapali? I hope I'm saying that even close to correct.
I'm not going to try.
All right. So I think it's Kanapali, Hawaii is the exact city we used. Drop the hammer, Dan. What's the median home cost?
$1.484 million.
Woo! That is a spicy meatball of a home price right there for a median home. So I think from a tax perspective, he is absolutely right. I hope he is enjoying the wonderful weather out there, but that is a heck of a home purchase if you want to live in that part of Hawaii.
And there are probably a lot of reasons to. Anyway, I'm sure it's worth it.
Yeah. I'm not putting Fairfax up against Hawaii as a better place to live, by the way. I just think you can get a home cheaper here. And I don't think our homes are that cheap.
No, certainly not.
All right, let's move on to our next question. This comes to us from Eric. He is a longtime listener as well. He says he's asking a question about investment allocation, that he hears the advice to delay Social Security until it maxes out, but that means that you draw down balances in the interim. If you're looking to pass wealth to heirs, what strategy makes sense? Because Social Security stops when you pass away, but life expectancies are increasing. The tie-in to allocation is how to factor pensions and Social Security in your targeted equity bond cash mix. Dan, how do you think about all that?
So there are a couple questions here. When we're talking about maximizing an estate for heirs, I think we just have to do the math is what it comes down to, because your spending is going to dictate which the optimal strategy is for you anyway. Because while it's true that delaying Social Security means you need to use more of your own resources early on to cover that shortfall, it could also mean that when Social Security kicks in, your distribution rate goes down massively and will allow your assets more time to compound into the future without having to disrupt that. So I think it could play out a number of different ways, and it's worth modeling them to see which is right for you specifically.
Yeah, in my experience, finding a little bit of additional stress against the portfolio in the early years to allow yourself to delay makes sense. And when I say a little bit of additional stress, I mean maybe a 5, 6, 6.5, as much as maybe 7% withdrawal rate against the portfolio if it's just for a limited period of time. If you start getting above that, where you get to like 8, 9, 10% withdrawal rates, the likelihood is you're going to put a lot of stress on the portfolio. Now, that completely depends on what your situation is once the Social Security kicks in. Maybe that kicks in and you've got a paid off mortgage and your expenses are fairly modest, and that's going to take 90% of your spending, right? And your portfolio can just coast from that point forward. Again, that might be worth it to spend heavily against the portfolio to buy yourself that really strong kind of purchasing power risk in the future, because you're locking in that heavy duty income stream that's going to basically carry you for the rest of your lifetime. For other people, that's not the case. And so we normally do this comparison. We look at what's the break even age on delaying. We look at what estimated portfolio values are in the future as a result of different filing strategies. So I think there's a lot of things to be considered there, but the break even age for most people is like 78 to 82 on when you're going to have gotten enough cash back that it was worth delaying in pure dollar terms, that you would have received as much or more from Social Security than you would have if you'd filed early.
Which makes total sense because of the way they calculate the growth in benefits or the reduction in benefits, right? They're calculating against a life expectancy. So they're expecting that on average, they're going to pay everyone basically a certain amount of the expected value. And then the longer you expect to live, the more it works in your favor to delay and get that increased payout from the program.
Yeah. So for people with longevity in their families, delaying becomes really smart for a lot of reasons, right? Because if you're going to potentially live into your 90s or even beyond, you're going to basically eat their lunch. Now, really, they're designed so that on average across the American taxpayer base, it's about the same. So they don't really care. They're going to have a few people that die early and they're going to say, mathematically, we won. And they're going to have some people live to 110 and mathematically they lose. That's all essentially going to even out for them if the program is designed properly, right? At a personal level, these are very meaningful things. I don't mean to talk so casually about somebody passing away early. That's not the point. But from a how Social Security is designed perspective, that's kind of how it's built to work.
Now, on the tail end of his question, he asks about how to factor pensions and Social Securities into your targeted equity bond cash mix. So how do you think about that? I know we touched on that as well in the past.
Yeah, so I think this is going to lead into our next question that we're going to address here as well, which is what we're really calculating for is the portfolio supported spend, right? And so I think that this is very different the way we have to approach this from a financial planning perspective than somebody would when they're thinking about their income, right? Most people, when they get a job, they get a salary, and then they're just going to kind of bake their budget into that salary, right? They're going to kind of use that top line, this is what I earn number, and then they're going to divvy that up into savings and spending categories and taxes, right? With retirement planning, what we're really looking for in most cases is a targeted spend number, right? That's kind of how we estimate it. So we're trying to figure out what you're going to need to spend to be comfortable, and then where are we going to have to take it from, or where can we take it from, and figure out if that's sustainable. If it's not, we kind of go back to the drawing board. And so, you know, from that perspective, yeah, I think it's going to affect the allocation, because the portfolio supported spend may be changing over the years, right? We might start before Social Security is kicked on. So portfolio supported spend might be really high, requiring kind of a fairly conservative portfolio early. And then maybe once those other income streams have kind of fully turned on, or you know, cash out an annuity and turn that stream of income on, and now we've got all this other stuff going, portfolio supported spend might be very low. And so what it creates is kind of a peak need for safety in the allocation, where right at the front end of retirement, you kind of need the most conservative portfolio you're ever going to need. And as you age, maybe the need to reduce risk actually comes down. And so that's one of the things that we've poked at and made fun of on this show, is that a lot of the glide paths for retirement are assumed to be the older you get, the more conservative your stuff needs to be. That's not really the case. For a lot of people, we see this situation where they need to be pretty conservative to handle that big portfolio spend. And then later in life, it can actually get more aggressive if they choose to, because they've got other stuff taking up some of that need.
Yeah. And a couple of weeks ago, we talked about the carve-out strategy, the five-year carve-out strategy for your portfolio. That's looking forward 5 years on your portfolio distribution needs and making sure that money is safe. So to reiterate Ross's point, in years where we don't have a pension or Social Security income stream on, your portfolio spending need might be higher because we need to make up for that money not being there yet. As we roll forward, that five-year forward-looking cash need might be lower as those income streams start turning on, meaning you can actually invest more of your portfolio than holding it back in safer assets like cash or short-term bonds.
That's exactly right. So that leads us right into Ed's question. Ed writes in from Minnesota, and he says, thanks for the carve-out episode. I especially like the idea of leaving asset allocation choices unrestricted in the long-term fund. But how would you roll this forward to year six and beyond? If I'm recharging the carve-out every year, then I might still be faced with pulling from the long-term assets at a bad time, and waiting until year four feels like it's reducing the certainty inherent in the strategy. I'm a little nervous from that question that we did a bad job of explaining kind of the second part of the strategy, which is really the decision tree part. But Dan, why don't you take us through how you view that?
I think it's always fair to assume we've done a bad job. So, but hopefully we can rectify this. So in that five-year window, we're not necessarily spending through from day one to the end of year five and then starting over. Each year, we have a decision to make about whether or not to replenish the cash in that bucket. And typically, the way we would do that, where if we have a normal or good market year, we would take some of the gains we experienced and use that to convert to cash and refill our bucket. In a below average to bad year, we might choose to delay that decision so we don't have to sell assets at a bad time. Now, where those ranges fall can be individual. I think referring back to a plan that you've made and having like clear-cut examples of what we consider average or good would be helpful to make it more formulaic than emotional. But that's really how we would look at it. We would make a recurring decision as to whether we should backfill that cash pot or wait until a better time.
Yeah, the number that I would throw out as the line in the sand is basically any year where you are north of the inflation rate, right? So if inflation is 3, if your portfolio earns 4% or more, right, just go ahead and replenish your carve out, right? And that's kind of our neutral position. So on any given year, what you're kind of hoping for is that you've got 5 years worth of what you need and you sleep like a baby. What we're trying to create is the ability to wait out a bad market if you needed to. And so in a bad year, you don't have to sell those things. And so, yeah, you can go 1, 2, 3, 4 years if you had to in a really negative environment and just kind of wait that out. And you're giving yourself that time. But that's really the hope, is that each year you're hoping that you can replenish it and get back to your neutral positioning, but you don't have to. You're giving yourself time to wait.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that allows a lot of flexibility too. So you're accounting for the possibility that there can be bad market times, which there are and there will be. but also understanding that when things are good and as designed to be, that you can constantly refill that cash position. Ed also mentions that he doesn't need a wine key because out there they do beer. Well, welcome to the club. I'm a beer guy too. They do have a bottle opener on the backside of the wine keys if you're drinking bottled beer, or if it's canned beer, then it's nice to look at and remember your good friends from check your balances every now and then.
Exactly. All right, let's move on to a question from Sean. He writes in, says he enjoys the show. Thank you, Sean. Says, I work as a county employee in California and have a 457 plan available to me. When I retire, can I roll that plan into an IRA and then convert it to a Roth IRA in order to avoid paying taxes? Dan, what do you have for Sean?
So there are a lot of flavors of retirement plans, and it can get very confusing when people throw around the most common ones, like 401k a lot. But you might have a 403b, you might have a 457b. There are also other flavors of 457 plans. But most commonly, a 457 plan is also a tax-deferred employer-sponsored plan. So when you retire, you do have the option, you should have the option to roll it into an IRA. But it's likely that you will need to roll that into a pre-tax IRA as well to avoid a taxable event. So while there is a path towards a Roth IRA, that would probably have to happen through a conversion, which would mean realizing income. So that's not necessarily a tax-free bucket for you in that 457, but you might be able to, over time, work it into a Roth in a tax-sensible way.
Yeah, so we've talked about Roth conversions a lot on our show, and I can see how it's easy to get kind of mixed up in some of these just because of how often and how frequently the words get used. We talked a couple weeks ago about a backdoor Roth. A backdoor Roth IRA conversion means that you're putting after-tax money into a traditional IRA and you're converting it, which is essentially going to be an almost tax-free transaction if you meet the certain conditions. Go back and listen to that show if you need to. Right. So a backdoor Roth, if you don't have any other pre-tax IRA assets or anything else of that nature, that is almost tax-free. And then that money is going to grow tax-free and come out tax-free. Right. That is the backdoor strategy. A regular Roth conversion means that you are choosing to pay taxes this year on the money that you're converting. So if you've got a regular 457, all pre-tax money, you have the choice after you roll that into a rollover IRA to, whether it's $1 or all of it, to make a conversion of those dollars. And when you do that conversion, you are saying to the government, I am choosing to treat this money as income this year, but I am not going to take it and put it in my pocket. I'm going to put it into this Roth IRA where I'm going to let it sit for at least 5 years, and then it will be tax-free forever. So very, very different between the backdoor and a regular Roth conversion. I just want to make sure that we really hammer that home, that those are two very, very different types of transactions with different impacts.
Roth conversations are unnecessarily difficult by all of the rules that are in place around them.
Yeah, no, it's just complicated. And we try to be really specific with our language. And I completely understand you're probably driving, you're in traffic right now, you're listening to these two idiots drone on and on about whether it's pre-tax or in my 457 or 403b. I get why people get this mixed up, but we are trying to be pretty specific with our language there to help you keep it as straight as you possibly can. So be careful, Sean, and absolutely check in with your CPA or a tax preparer before you make that conversion or any transaction that you are a little confused about. Right. So if there's anything in this that's going on, that's always the advice. We think working with a CPA, especially if you've never done these before, it's not that it's required, but I think it can help you avoid missteps and making mistakes. All right. Let's get into our final email of the week. This one comes to us from Melanie. I'm going to shorten Melanie's question down just a little bit. And I've got to say, I think Melanie's got kind of my dream plan going. So her question is about a secondary home and a primary residence. She says, last year, I bought a small retirement home in South Lake Tahoe so I can be a full-time ski bum when I retire. The home is rented out to full-time local residents. In about 6 years, I'm going to start the addition and remodel it. Meantime, in Santa Cruz, I just bought a primary home, which I plan to sell when I retire. I was happily renting a small place by the beach and the property was sold last month. In order to stabilize my housing costs for the next years, I decided to buy a small home. My question is, when I convert the Tahoe home, which right now is a second, into a primary residence, what implications does that have? Is there anything I should be doing now? There's a lot to unpack there, Dan. What do you got?
Yeah. So my mind immediately went to our conversation around property taxes and how a primary home may have different tax situations than a secondary home. So once you move, you will want to notify the tax authorities, the Department of Assessments and Taxations, that this is now your primary residence. There might be preferential tax treatment for doing so. Depending on what county you're in, they might treat that notification process differently. I know in Montgomery County, Maryland, where I'm from, they've started proactively mailing letters each year, basically asking you, is this a primary residence? And you need to fill out something that says yes. I imagine to go along with that, you'll want to let them know that the other one is no longer a primary residence, and they will tax you however they want to tax you on that thing. That's where my mind went to first. Is there anything you were thinking of when you read this note, Ross?
Well, a few things. So she says that the home she just bought, she's planning to be in it for 6 years. So that means on the home you just purchased, you are going to be at the, you're going to reach the exclusion. So if two of the last 5 years that's been your primary residence, you won't pay any taxes when you sell that home that you've been in. I think the other thing that I think of is when you're converting a rental, so that rental, you're likely going to be depreciating along the way, and then you convert that into your primary residence. If someday in the future you sold that Lake Tahoe residence, we're going to go back to the pro rata rule on how much time was it used as a primary residence versus how much time was it used as a rental. And so your exclusion amount, if you sell the Tahoe home, on how much of the capital gain you can exclude on that purchase, that's really going to depend on how long you ultimately live in it. So there's nothing you can do to really avoid that other than hopefully live in it, enjoy, be a ski bum as long as you possibly can, let it rip on the slopes. But that's really what's going to come into play when you sell the Tahoe home, is because you're not recognizing a capital gain when you convert it into a primary residence, but ultimately on the sale, I think that's what's going to be affected.
Yeah. And for the Santa Cruz home, if you're selling it, if you qualify for the exclusion, which again is 2 out of 5 years using it as a primary residence, you can exclude up to $250,000 of capital gains if you're a single filer. Or if you're a joint filer, it's up to $500,000. So it's not an unlimited exclusion, but it is pretty favorable.
Yeah. Yeah. So in many ways, I think that's a great plan and I'm very jealous. So when you get to Tahoe, let me know. We'll come ski. Dan will sit by the fire and sip cocoa, but I'll be out there on the slopes with you.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not a skier, but we're happy to accept any invitations to exotic locations that you care to throw our way.
Yeah, anybody that's got ski homes, we will come do an on-location show just for the privilege of coming out to visit with you. We can record Check Your Balances right in your living room, and you can see how unprofessional it actually looks. The other place you can see that is on our YouTube channel, which is where we are now posting all of our episodes. The link is in the description below. So if you would rather see us, we're trying to navigate several things, reading these questions and just figuring out where to look. I'm sure this episode looked crazy. I don't know that we've got a perfect system for how to do these mailbag episodes yet, but we're going to keep getting better at this. We promise. We're having a lot of fun. We hope you are as well. And we appreciate you tuning in this week.
Find us online on Instagram at Check Your Balances. If you want to get your question on an upcoming mailbag episode, the email address is checkyourbalances@outlook.com and somewhere on YouTube. Come find us.